Welcome to Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Ketzenberger. This week on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, we are continuing our look at the local dining scene by talking about where we've been and where we're going. We'll talk with Chef Greg Hardesty of Recess and Room 4, a James Beard semifinalist chef. Then we check in at the City Market with Chef Brad Gates of Gates Catering and The Pantry, and we'll hear about his experience and his views on where the city is headed. And then we'll stop by Bent Rail Brewing Company for an update from Chef Craig Baker about when the brewing will start. We'll talk about his World Food Championship competitions and also where he sees us headed as well. So stay with us for more here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. This week on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, we are continuing our focus on the local dining scene, and we're talking about where we've been and where we're going. And we're starting out today by sitting down with Chef Greg Hardesty of Recess and Room 4 to get his perspective. I talked with Greg recently about his career, where he's been, and how he got there.
I graduated from IU in 1991 and tried to sell vinyl siding for Sears, and that didn't work so well. Then I got licensed to sell health insurance, and I got stuck in a snowstorm at a farmer's house, and I had this big old Mercury Grand Marquis, and I got stuck in this snowstorm, and I just lost my mind, and I threw it in reverse and hit the thing, and I plowed out of there somehow, and I said, I'm going to go do what I want to do. And so I got a job at the Glass Chimney in 1992. It was February. It was like 2 weeks before Valentine's Day. And I got hired because I went to IU, and there was two chefs there, Tony Huelster and Dan Savka. And Tony was an IU fan, and I had graduated from Indiana University. And he said, well, we need another IU fan around here, so he hired me. That was the only credential that got me the job. So so you know, that was kind of where I started. And
yeah, had you worked in restaurants before that, in college or something?
My first job was at McDonald's. In Los Angeles, actually. My mom moved out there when I was a freshman in high school, and so I would go out there and spend the summers with her, and I was put on Big Macs, and I couldn't handle it. There was so many steps to a Big Mac. You can't believe how many steps there are to a Big Mac. And then they moved me over to Quarter Pounders. Couldn't do that. Then they moved me to the this is not an embellishment. Then I tried the Filet-O-Fish, and they finally just put me on the cash register, and so that was my first job. And then I worked at Crazy Horse when I was a senior at IU.
So it's not exactly a stellar background in at least when you were first starting out, right?
No,
it just cracks me up.
Yeah, and it was it's so funny that I became a chef after I think I'm a chef. When I grow up, I want to be a chef. But I couldn't handle the Big Mac station. It was like five steps, and it was just like you can't believe how, because this is before it was all mechanized. So.
Oh yeah, I remember the little jingle, all the things that go on, and two all beef patties, et cetera, et cetera.
Two all beef patties, special sauce, lettuce, cheese, pickles, onions, spicy bun.
That's it.
Hold the pickles, hold the lettuce. Special. That was Burger King.
Yeah, that was a competition. So you got, you were out of IU. You had a degree in public affairs.
Yep. SPIA. Yep.
So you're going to work in a restaurant. How did that start?
Well, it was sort of I think my sophomore year. I bought one of those hand hammered woks. Off the television. It was, you know, that British guy that, it was like, why is a British guy hawking hand-hammered woks? But it just made sense to me, apparently. And so I bought one of those things, and I started, I loved food as a kid. And there was, I mean, every memory I have is food-related. And I can remember my first cheeseburger, or the first tomato on a burger that I loved. I can remember my first Reuben. I can remember the first time I had crab legs, and my mom made them for me. On and on and on. So I always loved food, and so I started cooking for my roommates with that hand-hammered wok. I'd come home and probably might have had a drink or two, and in my sophomore year at at IU, and I found that giving my friends food just made me, it created something that was like, okay, I like this feeling. And so that's sort of what I, after I got in that snowstorm, I'm like, I'm going to go do what I want to do. So I called my dad and said, hey, I'm going to be a chef. Thanks for the 4 years of degree. I just got a job for $6 an hour making salads. So that's how it started.
So you're making salads at the glass chimney.
Yeah.
How was that? What was that kitchen like? Was it a very old school?
Yeah, very old school. And I feel like one of the luckiest, I feel like I was part of the last of a generation who got to see old classical continental cuisine, you know, table side stuff and just the way stuff was, you know. I think young chefs nowadays, they kind of riff on stuff, but they don't even know what they're riffing. I'm riffing on stuff that I actually saw, Chateaubriand and Tournedos and, you know, all those old classic recipes. You know, it was the same menu for 30 years, and Dieter Puska was he was a great chef and a great mentor. I didn't even know it at the time, but he was.
So, but from there then, you thought you pretty much had to get out of town and go somewhere and learn more, right?
Yeah, got married. We got married right after she graduated. She's an occupational therapist, and about a year into it, she was talking about, at some Christmas party, she was talking about this traveling occupational therapy program. And I overheard it, and I'm like, what? I was like, why aren't we doing this? And this was at Christmas time at a party, and we moved out there in March. It was just like, let's do it.
Out to L.A.?
Yep, to L.A., yep. And the beauty of that was I didn't have... she was making all the money. She still makes all the money. It allowed me to kind of take my time and find the right job. And that was the start of my, actually the glass chimney was the start of my good luck. Just like, okay, I'm going to be a chef. And then I find the best job or the best restaurant in the city at the time. And then moved out to LA and I ended up working for Joachim Schlichau. Again, probably the best chef at the time. Wolfgang Puck was the favorite, you know, the media darling, but Joachim was, and I just lucked into a job, and that's where we went.
Yeah, how long were you out there?
So L.A. for almost 2 years, and then because we were young and stupid, we said, hey, let's move to San Francisco, and so I quit my job, and we didn't have jobs. I moved all our stuff up to threw everything we had into a U-Haul, moved it up to San Francisco, put it in a storage unit, flew back, left my wallet on the airplane, and 2 days later we got in the car and we drove around the United States for about 6 or 8 weeks. We both had to be in, I had to be in St. Louis and she had to be in Fort Wayne for a wedding. We were both in weddings from our friends on the same day, so that was sort of the goal, but we had no agenda. So we moved up there, and then we came back, and neither one of us had jobs, and we stayed in a little rat-infested hotel for a couple weeks until we found jobs, and that's when I got a job at Rubicon then. So.
Wow, now that's very impressive. So you were out there working in some very, very high-profile places.
Yeah, and again, it's sort of the – now I should probably call it the you make your own luck, I guess, but it felt like everywhere I went, it just sort of fell into place. This is what I was supposed to be doing, and it worked out for me, and I was able to sort of grow in my own career and learn from people that knew what they were doing, and I just sort of shut my mouth and kept my head down and said, yes, sir, and it was a brutal 5.5 years. I mean, I was I've been punched before in the chest. So,
oh wait, now talk a little bit about the atmosphere, the sort of old school atmosphere that was probably prevalent in kitchens at the time.
Yeah, I think it's the beauty of the glass chimney experience was I had worked for a European already, so and they definitely have the sort of brigade system where you don't talk back. You just say yes, sir. In fact, it with Joachim, I couldn't say yes, sir, or I couldn't say yes, chef. It had to be yes, sir. And if you said, yes, chef, he would say, there's a million chefs, but there's only one of me, you know, in this little German accent. You know, and working for Dieter, he was a hard guy to work for. It was never good enough. It was par for the course because I played baseball and basketball growing up all my life and played in high school. And, you know, I was used to having coaches yell at me. You know, that was just part of the norm. And being a slow white kid, I got yelled at a lot. You know, I didn't move my feet very well, and I used to get burnt baseline a lot. So I was used to sort of getting my name called in a negative way. So the kitchen just became sort of my new sport. It was like it's competitive, it's physical, there's teamwork, there's a leader. You know, so for me, it's being a chef has always been sort of my new athletic adventure.
We've been talking with Chef Greg Hardesty of Recess and Room 4 in Indianapolis. Stay with us for more on the changes that are coming to his restaurants here on WFYI and WFYI.org. As we continue to explore the Indianapolis restaurant scene here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, we have to talk about change. Chef Greg Hardesty has been a restaurateur here in Indianapolis for the past 15 years and is a driving force in the evolution of the local dining scene. I talked with Greg recently about how kitchens have changed, how he's changed, and about the changes coming to Recess and Room 4. So do you think that people who maybe haven't had those kinds of experiences, haven't worked in a tough kitchen, have they missed something?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think that this generation is a little softer, a little bit more, you know, in the media right now, especially with sports, there's a lot of talk about, you know, everybody gets a trophy kind of thing. And I think that, I definitely think there's an aspect to that is missing. I know that just having been doing this for 15 years now as an owner, I came into it. I tried to be like Joachim and Dieter and Reina Schwartz, another Austrian that I worked for. You know, I tried to be that tough guy, and it did. It always made me feel worse than I think that I made any employee feel. So I was never comfortable with that. But I think that there is something to getting yelled at and understanding that it's only for the good of the team, you know, and I don't think that some of the younger kids can handle that anymore. And so I definitely manage, chef, own differently than I did 15 years ago.
So do you yell in the kitchen? Do you still yell? Did you ever yell?
I did yell at the beginning. I mean, if anybody wants to text Neil Brown, you could ask him about it. He's got a good classic story, as well as Eli Anderson. But I don't anymore. Like I said, it wears me out more than, you know, I wake up, and at the end of the day, I'm pretty soft-hearted, and, you know, I try to be a little bit more calm. And frankly, people just don't respond to it anymore. You know, I mean, people walk out. They'll just literally just, okay, I quit, you know. And so that's my experience, at least.
Talk a little bit about the progression of some of your restaurants. You know, we're at Recess, and then there's Room 4. You started H2O Sushi and Elements. Talk a little bit about your career. Has there been a progression? Has one thing led to another?
Being out there in San Francisco is when I discovered sushi, started eating it, and it became an absolute obsession. When I moved back, sushi became sort of the vehicle to say, okay, I can be a chef. And then that led to, you know, H2O and some critical nice success. And then my ego took over, and I started doing little specials Then all of a sudden, oh, I should open another restaurant, and that was called Elements.
Now, how is that, having two restaurants at the same time?
Worst 2 years of my life. I absolutely hated it. All I did was drive back and forth and put out fires. I hated it. So we sold H2O, and, you know, we kept Elements for another, I think, almost 6 years. And that led to selling that one as well. And then... I took another 2 years off.
But in that 2 years, I think you were probably, you know, refining the next concept, right? Which turned out to be Recess. Now, how did that develop a little bit?
Yeah, you know, my dream has always been to have a restaurant where everything that I can get my hands on, I can put in one menu. I hate when, you know, there's these beautiful tomatoes and this gorgeous broccoli, and you order one of the dishes and not the other. So that was always my goal, is to put it all in one menu, and that's why we do the pre-fee menu at Recess. And the H2O, the sushi experience, was such a refining, like, less is more experience that I think really has probably defined my style of cooking more than anything, is if you put one less thing on the plate, you've just put more love on the plate, kind of thing. And so that was sort of what I wanted to do with Recess, and it became Recess. There was several names that I wanted to use. The Tickled Monkey was one that got shot down really quickly by my wife and my two daughters, which I think you're laughing right now, and I think it's great.
Yeah. Where did that come from?
It just popped in my head one day. I'm like, the Tickled Monkey. It just makes you laugh, you know. So I thought it puts a smile on your face. What the hell? But so the Tickled Monkey got shot down, and then the Soft Parade was really the original idea. So it ended up being Recess. I don't know how that happened. Well, I do know how it happened, I guess. It's because I said, you know what, I'm going to do what I want to do. Recess is you go out and you play, you have fun, there's no rules, you make it up as you go. That's what Recess is.
So now the progression from Recess was to Room 4.
Yeah, again, one of those ego things where I thought that more was better. Okay, I'm going to admit it right now. I'm a junk food junkie. I love cheeseburgers. I love tacos. I love salty stuff. I have a horrible diet. I don't eat. You know, everybody's like, oh, you must eat so well. I'm like, no, I eat like crap. So Room 4 was sort of my, I'm gonna open a cheeseburger place, you know. And I named it Room 4 because I was literally like planning it, and I had a folder with sort of all my notes and stuff of what I wanted to do, and I just wrote the number, just a big 4 on this envelope that I was keeping everything in. And I was like, okay, there it is, Room 4. It's the fourth room of food that I'm going to open. That's why it's called Room 4. So, you know, I love it and I hate it at the same time. Again, it's sort of like owning two restaurants. And I have just recently started doing sushi every other Thursday, which it's still a passion. It's still my favorite food to eat. It's a real pain to do it every single day, to maintain that level of quality. So every other Thursday we do a sushi night, and we just do an omakase style, which is like 6 or 8 courses predetermined. And this is what you're eating. The beauty of that is then we have Friday and Saturday to use up whatever fish is left. The beauty of also right now is, the fish that I can get my hands on now compared to what I could get 15 years ago when I opened H2O, is phenomenal. It's the world is so small now. I mean, I can order something from Hawaii at noon today, and it'll beat me here before I get here at noon the next day. Yeah, and so I'm doing it every other Thursday, and that's sort of kind of getting back to the Room 4, you know, what we're going to, the little changes we're going to do. It's opened my eyes and sort of said, all right, I need to do something new. The restaurant's going to be 6 years old, coming up here in about 3 months, and I'm bored. And rather than selling it like I've done with all the other ones and starting over and putting myself in $250,000 debt again, I'm going to just make some changes and offer a little bit more sashimi, some oysters, capture that driving home from work. I don't want to sit down for 2 hours and have 4 or 5 courses of food, but just grab a drink and have a little sashimi. So that's sort of where we're going with it. I would never say exactly what I'm doing because, geez, I'm so random that I couldn't, like, you know, I don't even know what I'm doing tomorrow, and we're, you know, I haven't written the menu tomorrow. I haven't opened the refrigerator to see what's in there. So, you know, it'll be a lot of the same thing, just going to probably eliminate the burger and tacos and go a little healthier, a little fresher, and also try to capture on some of the private party business. It's a real great moneymaker. And so, you know, it's just it's a little less work, hopefully, and a little more money, and a little more fun, and just something new. Reinvent myself, make it fun again. I feel like I'm opening a new restaurant again, you know, and that's it's clearly what drives me. I'm not a very good long-term owner. I'm not good at doing the same thing over and over again. And so, any time that I can do something new, something that drives me, something that I don't know how to do, a challenge. I'm a competitive person, so anytime I have a competition and feel like I've got to learn something, I like that.
We've been talking with Chef Greg Hardesty of Recess and Room 4 in Indianapolis. For more information on his restaurants, go to recessindy.com. In looking at the changes on the restaurant scene, you really have to look back more than a few years. So that's what I did recently with Indianapolis chef Brad Gates of The Pantry and Gates Catering. We looked back at the nearly 25 years since he graduated from culinary school and talked about the changes in how the culinary world sees itself and about the twists and turns that his career has taken over the years.
When I was at French Culinary, and I went out to eat a lot, spent a lot of money, had no money, but spent a lot, and I went out to like the top 50 restaurants. The Zagat opened up. The Zagat went to top 50 restaurants, and I, when it came time to look for a job, and going to the guidance counselor and such, I just decided I was gonna all those 50 restaurants. I was gonna hand deliver my resume, which was nothing, right? At Club 30 and French Culinary Institute in Ball State, and I hand delivered that resume to like 35 of the top 50 restaurants. I didn't go to the sushi restaurants and things like that, but I delivered them and I got some callbacks. I got four good callbacks. I got Prefi, which was Terrence Brennan, and I got Gotham Bar and Grill, which was Alfred Portale. I got Michael Romano at Union Square, and I got Tom Colicchio at a restaurant called Mondrian. And at the time, Mondrian was my absolute favorite restaurant in the city, and I wanted to take a job there. It was Prep. All of them were Prep except for Union Square. Union Square was the, well, it's Prep, but it's an oyster station. You shuck oysters and make tuna salad sandwiches all day. And you don't realize that how big of a task that is until you get in there to do it. It was huge. But I liked Gotham, but Gotham was more of like a stage. It was like $7 an hour, and I had to pay rent, so I couldn't do that. That was crazy. It was, and then the other one was Prefi. That I kind of knocked off because I wasn't a huge fan of the restaurant, even though I liked Terrence Brennan. That restaurant was super casual. It didn't last long. It was based on like $15 Prefi menu, and he just ran this like two Prefis every day and changed it every day. And it was cool, but it wasn't my thing necessarily. So I was kind of looking at Mondrian, which was Pantry or Prep, and then the Pantry was Union Square, and my only thing that kept me from going to Mondrian was it was empty. Every time I went in there, it was empty, and it was just one of those things that was like what we were talking about earlier, where the cards just didn't fall right, because he was fantastic at that restaurant. And fortunately, he came onto Union Square later and was working at Gramercy, but so I didn't take that job. I took the job at Union Square, and so I was, shucking oysters. The day after I graduated, I was shucking oysters. I still have a scar right here where, like, the second day at Union Square, I shoved an oyster knife into my thumb.
Oh, my God.
I thought I was done, right? As, like, second day, like, oyster. They'd take me to the hospital with the oyster knife stuck in there. And I'm just like, oh. And all I can think about is I kind of suck at shucking oysters. What am I going to do? So I finally got used to it. I was being schooled by the prep crew. You know, the prep crew would come over and help when you got a bunch of oysters, and these guys are looking at me like, what is this guy doing here? You know, he stinks at oysters. But, you know, it just beats you. It just, you either get it or you're going to not be there anymore. So it was just one of those things that they just, you know, they're persistent. And
so that was
on you. Great educators in the kitchen.
So that was the early 90s, right?
That was 90, that was late 91. Like September of 91. So French Culinary was only 6 months. It was very intensive for those 6 months, but they teach it all to you and then they knock you out the door. On a note about the culinary school, when I went to culinary school, when I graduated, they told me, they basically told me at graduation, they're like, you better go somewhere and peel carrots, right? You're just going to go peel carrots and do prep and watch how kitchens work. You know, this is what, you're not a chef. You know, they specifically told me, you're not a chef.
So they told you that, because that's a complaint these days from chefs about culinary school graduates, is they come out, they think that they're a chef, right?
A big deal. Yeah, and that contributes, and we can talk about that too, the what we are going through in the back of the house as far as talent goes in this town. There's talent there, but when there is talent, they're being graduated as a chef, and so they're going to open a restaurant instead of working in a kitchen somewhere, or working for Artisty, or working for me, or working for Chris Ely, or doing whatever. You know, that's not happening right now. So
you knew when you got out that you were going to peel carrots.
Yeah, I was a grunt, and everyone there was a grunt, and every teacher in that school let you know that on a consistent basis, that you were a grunt. And I think that, I mean, it may be kind of brutal sounding, but I think it's the way it kind of should be, and the truth of it is that a lot of people get into it, and they label themselves as a chef, or they're labeled as a chef when they graduate culinary school, and man, they have a lot to learn, and they're missing out on so much. You know, I still am learning new stuff every single day. And I can say I'm a chef, but I can't ever say that I know it all. I'm ready for it. And I think once you designate yourself as a chef, that sort of has a something that goes along with it that says, I know this, this, and this, and this, you know, including how to run a restaurant. And if you just graduated culinary school and you don't have any experience prior to that, you're not a chef. You can call yourself that, but and I think restaurants, that's can happen with restaurants where you open them and they don't necessarily know the whole what goes into it, and then once they get into it, it's too late. You know, it's too late. Oh, I don't know this. I don't know what I'm doing.
So that's a problem today that we see with new culinary school graduates. But this was 25 years ago, right? So 25 years ago. Then what happened when you got out and you knew you were going to be peeling carrots somewhere?
Yeah, so I worked basically every position in that kitchen over the next 3 years. And it was brutal. I mean, you know, the garmanger station, the pantry area, was the oyster shucker, which was me, and then there was the head pantry person. And that I'd moved up to that, and I worked that day and night. And then I went on to the pasta station. Just when you think you're hot stuff on the cold side, then you move to the pasta station and you get your butt kicked every single night. And I mean, I remember having the sous chef Mark Dorian come up to me. He goes, "You're not quitting on me, are you? Because I must have looked like somebody beat me up, you know?" He goes, "You get back on the line and you produce." He goes, "You're not quitting. I'm not letting you quit." And I never said anything about quitting. I just must have looked that way, you know? But it was brutal. I mean, I felt like I'd been hit by a train every day. But then you take that step. This is what I'm talking about, like getting out of culinary school and going into a restaurant, because I thought I was doing well on Grand Manger. Then I get into the next step, which is the hotline, and you're doing 350 covers a night, and it's just you and two other guys on the hot side, and it's supposed to be three-star food. Yeah, it's brutal. And that is, you think, okay, well, I know everything there is to know. Then you take that position, and you're like, okay, I don't know anything again, you know, and then you have to build your way up to getting the competency and knowing how to do that station along with the progression of the hotline. So I think it's those experiences are really, really important.
We've been talking with Chef Brad Gates of The Pantry and Gates Catering. Stay with us for more from Brad here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. So I keep asking chefs lately, where do you think the Indianapolis food scene is headed? Where have we been and where are we going? This week, in addition to Chef Greg Hardesty, who we talked with earlier in today's program, I also sat down with Chef Brad Gates of The Pantry and Gates Catering. I stopped by the Indianapolis City Market, where The Pantry is located, and we talked about where he's been, what he's doing now with The Pantry, and where he sees the local food scene going. These days, you are at The Pantry in the City Market. So tell me about that. And so going from the Bugs Temple time to now.
Yeah, the Pantry is, you know, we moved into the market. I was doing this out of my house. So I was, left Bugs Temple. My wife was still working there. And And I decided, I did interview for a couple jobs, JW and a couple things like that. And I talked to a couple people about investments and restaurants and things like that. And I got to tell you, the first thing I thought was, I don't want to work for anybody anymore. I've worked for other people my whole life. I don't work for anybody anymore. So this was the solution. At least I thought it was a temporary solution. And then I'm just going to do some catering out of the house and call it a day. But it grew. I mean, it kept us sustained. Like, I didn't think we were going to make a living off it. And so we got to the point where I was getting too big for the house, and Roger and Cindy over here. And I was always talking with them, and Roger's like, you know, that's the spaces are open. And originally, we were talking about spaces in the middle of the market, which wouldn't work because I need to cook, too. I need the stoves and all that. So this place was originally meant for the Chef's Academy. And that didn't happen. It fell through. And as soon as it fell through, Roger called me. It's like, hey, you know, that space, Chef's Academy space is open. So I called Vicky and Stevie, and that connection was made. The pantry's done well. It's steadily increased. And now we can't open as many hours as we want to because the catering's still in the same space. So I try and do, when we have catered events, I try and work the opposite hours they work. At one point, I was doing both. So until I got John Michael. I'm thankful for that because John Michael, who's a chef, is running the pantry now and doing a great job. So I don't have to, that's one less thing I have to worry about.
Talk a little bit about where you see the Indianapolis dining scene going, you know, where, you know, what maybe some of our challenges are and where you think we can be.
Yeah, I mean, I'm in a good position because with the pantry is not losing money and we're doing well there. And the catering's doing really well. So I have the advantage of being able to look from the outside in and look at all my friends and other chefs that are opening these restaurants. And, yeah, you know, I think we're headed in the right direction. I think we, to some respect, we have to kind of drag some of the clientele with us and say, hey, it really is good. You know, you really got to go there, and you're not paying any more than you would, or as a matter of fact, you're paying less than you would if you went to so-and-so over here or Palomino or whatever. You know, try this out. So I think that the more of these sorts of things and the more of the reviews and those things, that'll drive us. Now, I will say that whatever we write about as a community is probably what's going to get followed. So we have to be careful what we write about. Because, you know, I made a comment on Facebook, and I know it probably didn't please any food writer. But it was National Cheeseburger Day the other day, and I was just like, seriously, wasn't it just National Hamburger Day like a week ago? But I think we get in the danger of cornering ourselves by talking too much about the burgers and the mac. And believe me, I sell sliders here and mac and cheese and stuff. But I think if we want to progress, and like what you were talking about, we're moving forward in it, we got to start talking about other things besides the burgers so much. Because I love burgers, don't get me wrong. I eat a burger a day if I could. But I think the serious foodies want to read about what's cool and interesting. You know, Facebook's interesting because obviously it wasn't around when I was doing these things. But Jonathan does a great job, and a lot of these chefs do a great job of putting it out there, putting their pictures of food. I do it sometimes when I can. I think that's a really, really good resource if you're a foodie to like these guys on Facebook and see what they're doing, because this is coming straight from, a lot of times nobody's even eaten that dish yet. Like, it's, that dish was just made, he's still playing with it, you know,
And that's a big change that we've seen, you know, the communicating directly with the customers through social media.
Yep. Yeah, I agree. I think that's our marketing right now. I mean, our marketing is really word of mouth, but yeah, we do a lot through Facebook, and I find it to be more productive on the personal Facebook than the business Facebook. You know, I haven't been to Cerulean in a while, but I want to go just because of what I see Alan doing on Facebook, right? You know, it's a big deal. But I think as far as the food community goes, the bloggers and all the writers, yeah, I think that's a good part of it too, where we can get from the burgers to the you know, the salt cod or whatever is being fixed. So
now, do you see,
I think chefs think that way probably more than the readers do, but I think a lot of chefs probably look at that and like, let's write about the, you know, snapper, let's not write about the burger. So.
Now, what are some other challenges that you think that our local food community faces in growing and getting bigger and getting more national attention?
I think getting your foot in the door, and Jonathan stands a great chance at that. I think Alan does too. I haven't eaten his food in a long time now, but you can recognize it. Sometimes, this is kind of maybe a little of experience in New York. You can sit in front of a plate and look at that plate and be like, this is really great, but it's probably not going to be James Beard great. But this is really great, and it looks exactly like something that would be nominated for a James Beard Award. So not that I'm right or wrong, but I look at it and something clicks sometimes. I'm just looking at a picture or looking at them. If that tastes good, that's some serious stuff right there. So I think that sort of notoriety is huge.
We've been talking with local chef Brad Gates of The Pantry and Gates Catering. For more information on Brad, go to bradgatescatering.com or find it on Facebook. As the Indianapolis restaurant scene continues to grow, the number of breweries grows right alongside it. And that is exactly what's happening at Bent Rail Brewery. Local restaurateurs Craig Baker and Derek Means opened their latest project back in February at 5301 Winthrop Avenue, right on the Monon Trail. And it's taken a while, but Bent Rail will likely be serving its own beer very shortly. I stopped by the brewery recently to talk with Chef Craig Baker about the beer, as well as about the local dining scene and where he sees that headed. Tell me a little bit about what you have coming up at Bent Rail. I know the beer is going to be coming on very soon, right?
Yeah. Boiler's getting hooked up now. So they've been here almost 2 weeks. We're staring at the truck. and then glycol comes in and cold room. But I'm hoping to be able to clean tanks early next week. That gets us off the ground. So it's good. We're moving along quickly.
So tell me what kind of beers people can expect at the start.
Our brewer, Bradley's taken our ideology for our restaurant start. So he's doing a local oatmeal pale ale. So it has the body of almost like a, kind of like a Boddington's, if you will. And then we have a maple pecan brown. And then we're going to have a Kolsch. So our goal was to create beers that are session beers and that are very palatable to the mainstream, including pricing. So we're trying to create like a working man's beer.
So it'll be very accessible,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that's our goal is to be like we're not going to try to compete with some of the more established, bigger brands. So what we're looking to do is develop markets where we can not take tap handles from our friends, one, and two, we can go in and kind of take tap handles from the bigger breweries by making beer that would be very approachable.
And tell me how that goes along with the philosophy of the restaurant.
So a lot of the ingredients that we're using in the beers we're sourcing locally. The goal was to make a farm-to-table restaurant that was approachable for families, and so we introduced that into the market in a way that we can then expand it. So those are sticking with those kind of principles. That was the basis for the brewery, and it still enables us to do wacky, crazy beers that we need to charge more for. But that's going to be our front three to roll out.
So now, will the beer just be available at the brewery, or will other places have it as well?
So when we first open, once we get production up, we'll start distributing outside to other restaurants. We're going to initially stay in the Indianapolis area, and then we're going to branch out to Muncie.
Why Muncie? Is there a reason for that?
I feel like they have a great beer community, and I think we can embrace it well because it's true. Like, the beers are very, even though they're kind of a rift, they're true to the style. So they're, like I said, super approachable, and I think it's, you can drink a lot of them because the ABV is low. So I think it's a good for that market. And then after that, we'll figure out what we're going to do. But that's kind of the plan.
Let's talk a little bit about, I've been thinking lately about the local food scene, and where it's been and where it's going. How would you characterize what's happening? What's your take on everything?
we're in a renaissance right now. Like, there's between the breweries, the distilleries, the independent restaurants, the community's really exploding. The support has been huge. I think it started with the farm to table movement, and people getting involved with like their farms and seeing the effects that of keeping their money local. And then I think that there's a lot of Hoosier pride involved, and I think people are seeing that, and it's recognized by how well the beer scene has been embraced. So I think it's great. I think there's still a lot of room to go, what we have.
We haven't reached capacity, we're not oversaturated?
I don't think so. I think that the thing that's going to limit us is staff and talent and, you know, being able to get people trained and into the industries quick enough and in all those sectors. In the beer community, you have a lot of people who started out as home brewers and then transitioned into production, and that's difficult. It would be best, I think, if the culinary schools can keep up and we can get more people to move from surrounding cities. With the influx from Chicago and people coming down, I think people are also realizing that they can open a restaurant here for about half of what it probably cost in Chicago. And I think some of the, you know, not to pick on celebrity chef Michael Simon, but he caught on pretty quick. So, I think we're getting national attention, and I think it's good. Brooks is pulling in all kinds of stuff. I think it's only going to get better as people start to recognize that, you know, what's going on. And because mainly I don't think people outside of Indiana know that what's happening here.
So we're sort of an untapped market nationally. They just, you know, the attention hasn't landed here yet, but maybe it is, right? Maybe it's starting to.
Yeah, I think it's getting there. I mean, with all the guys that cooked at the Beard House and other things that people are doing that are national focus, I think it's good to see that, one, I'm speaking from myself, my personal experience, some of these national people are embracing what we're doing here, as far as like a style of cuisine. I kind of feel like we're separating ourselves consistently now from Chicago and Louisville, and I had someone, a judge, say to me, who's a beard person, she was like, "The moment I put it in my mouth, I knew it was that you were from Indiana." And so, like,
well, now that's kind of nice, I think, right?
Yeah, well, that's what I was going for, right? It's like, how do I get this across in a way? We were supposed to, it was the International Farm to Table Conference, and we were trying to reference our point of view on food in that region. So I thought it was the biggest compliment I could have. I didn't win, but it was still like the biggest compliment I could have. And I think that those experiences, as we grow more and more, that's going to happen. And so we'll get out more and more.
We've been talking with local chef Craig Baker of Bent Rail, Plow and Anchor, and the local eatery and pub. Stay with us for more from Craig on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Indianapolis chefs and restaurants have been getting some national attention lately, and more local chefs are stepping out onto a bigger stage. Chef Craig Baker, for example, will be competing in the World Food Championships in November, along with pastry chef Cindy Hawkins of Circle City Suites and chef Matt Stumm of the local eatery and pub. Now, Craig has participated in the World Food Championships for the past 2 years, and I talked with him recently about what's involved in the championships and why he likes it.
I'm excited about this, actually. But it's 500 competitors in 9 different brackets, I think.
Now tell me what bracket you'll be in.
So I'm in seafood. My bracket's right now is tough. It's stacked. I've got like three Food Network people in it, and I've got one contestant from Top Chef who came in second.
So this is a tough crowd you're going up against.
Well, it's for a lot of money. If you win, you get $100,000 for 3 days' work. It's pretty competitive. And it's not just professionals. There's a lot of, like, professional contest people.
Like the people who do the barbecue circuit, things like that?
Yeah, the barbecue actually has their own bracket. They don't get to compete in the finals this year. If they win, they win $50,000. And they win national. That's the national championship. But, like, people who just do recipe contests for money, like, as a living, like, this is what they do. And they win, like, a lot of money every year doing this, including, like, national contracts for spokespeople and that kind of thing. So it's a little intimidating. I know one woman who I'm friends with, and she won $150,000 last year just writing recipes. So she's methodical. And so when you're going into a competition, it's tough because she's been practicing for 3 months. I have to work in the kitchen. So like last year, the dish that I did for the finals, I had never made before.
So that was my question is, do you know what you're cooking when you go in?
So first round, you usually know what you're going to do, and you're dictated limitations on who your sponsors are. So last year was Alaskan Seafood, and you get thrown all kinds of curveballs. So temperature went down to 38 degrees. The reefer truck froze all the fish. So we're like rolling in, and everything's frozen, and then you're cooking outside. So it's difficult, and when our turn-in time happened, it's 55 degrees. I had a stocking cap on the whole time. We baked our plates at 450 degrees to try to keep it hot. And I talked to one of the judges at the end, and, he was the certified master chef from McCormick, like the spice company. Right. So he's super critical anyway. And he's like, your dish was awesome, but he's like, it was cold. And the guy that won made pot pie. So it's like it levels the playing field out. Like, doesn't matter how good you are. Like, you never know who your judges are. One, and you know if what the weather's going to be like, and when you pre-plan like that so far in advance, you can't like change it based on, you know. So you kind of roll the dice, and but it's a lot of fun, and you get to meet a lot of great people, and I think that having as many, there could be more of us going from Indiana. Right now I just know that it's the three of us, but it would be great if we could get a few more and have a team. I'm trying to put together some extra stuff to kind of promote. The entire thing is usually televised. Not usually, it is. So this year I'm hoping to put together some kind of like NASCAR out of chef's coat for the team, so that we can represent local companies and kind of get a little more spotlight and attention.
Do you like that kind of competition thing? Is it enjoyable?
I love it. I can't lie. I love it. It's so much fun. I mean, it's the adrenaline, you know, and I'm an adrenaline junkie. So it's, yeah. I mean, you go into it and it's competitive, but everyone's really friendly. And at the end of it, you really can't be mad at your competitor. Like, people get aggravated because you never know what the judges are going to say. But at the end of the night, then we all go have a couple beers, and it's all good.
Now, tell me again when it is.
So it's November 3rd through the 10th. You know, so hopefully I'll get to stay to the 10th. That's the finals. But the other thing is like, it's, they build 50 or 60 kitchens in the open air, and Kenmore donates all the appliances. So it's like a full kitchen, refrigerator, stove, oven, every gadget you can pretty much think of.
But it's outside.
It's all outside. So it's, I kind of was wondering, I was like, why would you move to Florida during hurricane season? But, you know, whatever.
So do you cook outside even in the bad weather? Like you said, it was cold last year. So even if it rains, you'll be cooking?
You're exposed. And you're under a clock, like, pretty strict. Not pretty, it's very strict. If you're late, you're out. And it's not so much an issue for the professionals because it's 12 plates, right? Like, if you can't make 12 plates in 2 hours, then you got real problems. But a lot of the home contestants get beat up pretty bad by the time regulations because they're overly aggressive. And then, like, equipment won't work. And, you know, or somebody, because everyone goes through those kitchens. So, like, day three, like everything's broken or it's missing pieces or, you know, it never made it from the dish area back out. And it gets frustrating. So the first thing I do is when I go in is I find everything and test it to make sure it works because you never know, like, what's going to happen. And if it doesn't work, I steal one from the guy next to me. So it's all, you got to make it even.
And even with all of that, even with all the challenges, you still like it?
Oh, I love it. It's great. I mean, after 2 years in Vegas, now I know a lot of people there. And we keep the same ideology. So when we go, you know, we were one of the few teams who rented a car last year. And then we went to all these farms. And, like, I know you're like farms in, you know, Las Vegas, but we've, you know, had microgreens that we got from someone who has a you know, indoor, and we went to all these places, and we went to the farmer's market, and then we bought all of our stuff in Vegas that was all local, so it was awesome.
We've been talking about the upcoming World Food Championships with Craig Baker of Bent Rail Brewery, Plow and Anchor, and the local eatery and pub. For more information on the championships that take place November 3rd through the 10th, go to worldfoodchampionships.com. You've been listening to Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Ketzenberger. Thank you so much for tuning in to Eat Drink Indiana Radio this week. And thanks also to our guests, Chef Greg Hardesty of Recess and Room 4, Chef Brad Gates of The Pantry and Gates Catering, and Chef Craig Baker of Bent Rail Brewing Company, Plow and Anchor, and the local eatery and pub. And thanks also to producer John Katzenberger for helping to bring you Eat Drink Indiana Radio.